Welcome to Uncommons. I'm Nate Erskine-Smith, and on this episode, I'm joined by Laurel Collins. She's the MP for Victoria, she's the NDP environment critic, and she was elected for the first time in 2019. Now, before her election, she served for a short time as the city councillor. She's also been a very vocal advocate locally around climate and around supporting those in need, including victims of domestic abuse, in Parliament. She's focused on many of those same issues, and I've worked together with her to phase out fossil fuel subsidies and been vocal on that front. She's very vocal most recently around establishing a youth climate corps, and that's why we initially invited Laurel to Uncommons. We want to talk about this shared priority, and we want to see this through in this coming budget. Now, you'll see the conversation goes on, a little pointed at times on disagreements around climate action and the progress we've seen. But overwhelmingly, Laurel and I share priorities as it relates to stronger climate action. We aren't done yet. We need to do more. And it's really good to hear her perspective.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I was interested in having you on for a few reasons, but I was mostly interested in starting with, at least, and we could talk about lots of different things, but starting with this idea of a youth climate corps, because it's something that I've talked about, something you've talked about. You've got a motion in Parliament on it right now, and I hope we see it realized in the budget. But let's first start at the beginning for those who are uninitiated in the idea. What do you want to see when it comes to a youth climate corps, and why do you think it's so important?
Yeah, maybe I'll start with the second half of that, why it's so important. You know, we are facing a climate emergency. And it's not only that young people are scared about their future, they're seeing, you know, the devastating impacts of the climate crisis, whether it's heat domes here in BC that killed hundreds of people, extreme flooding, forest fire season starting in February, hurricanes on the East Coast that are becoming more severe, more frequent. The smoke that is choking folks every summer now because of the wildfires. It is here now, and young people feel this acutely. There's been lots of research about, the vast majority of them are worried about climate change. The majority of them are so worried that it's impacting their day-to-day lives. So it's really important for us to give young people a path to engage in tackling the climate crisis that is tangible and that not only provides hope, but also will make a meaningful impact on bringing down our GHG emissions, creating more climate resilient communities, doing the things that we know are so desperately needed right now. And it could be a transformative program. You know, if the federal government was willing to invest in our young people, in the clean jobs of the future, we could make a significant impact on, bringing down greenhouse gases, in, retrofitting all of our buildings all across Canada. We know that buildings are the third highest emitters of GHG. It's a sector that is the third in Canada in terms of releasing greenhouse gases. And, we could have good green jobs in local communities where people can stay and have family sustaining work.
How do you imagine though, when it comes to specifically engaging on the youth side, do you imagine it to be complementary then to it? There's a number of dollars flowing into sustainable jobs and training on that front. Do you imagine it's complementary and these programs work together in a holistic way? Or do you imagine they're separate with different focuses and different goals?
I see them as holistic, and I think it's important for us to link it into sustainable jobs. The funding going into sustainable jobs, the Sustainable Jobs Act, it is very complementary. And I think the danger, I would say, would be to treat it as a separate and small program. And I think when I've spoken to folks, oftentimes I think people think of Canada Summer Jobs or Katima Vic, and these are, programs that absolutely have been and are wonderful, need investment on their own. But this is not what we're imagining. We're imagining something much more large scale, much more transformative. There was a recent study about the Youth Climate Corps, and over 1 million young people said that they would consider enrolling in this type of program. We want to make sure that we have pathways for young people to engage in the jobs of the future. And this is one tangible way that the federal government could do it.
And at a very small cost in the grand scheme of overall climate action and overall global efforts, but efforts in Canada in particular. And it's not a new idea in the sense that I would say our American allies have not been so focused on climate change in many ways, and they don't have the same overriding ambition, I would say, in reducing emissions that we see in other parts of the world. And I would say, you know, we could have a debate about the ambition here in Canada, but Biden's behind this idea. And if they can get it done in the US, surely we can get it done here in Canada.
Yeah. And, you know, I definitely would contend that we have a long way to go when it comes to how Canada is doing to meet our climate targets. You know, we are not on track to meet our international climate targets. And it's part of the reason that I want a program like this. But yeah, the U.S. has implemented a citizens climate corps and are on their way to employing 20,000 people. And also, you know, the U.S. has a ton of smaller size kind of conservation corps already in existence. And I think that's one thing we could learn. We have a few climate corps here in Canada. We have the BC Youth Climate Corps, and there are other smaller groups that it would be good to connect with, learn how they're working on the ground, how can we invest in them. I've met with a number of our American counterparts to hear how the climate corps work is going in the U.S. And there's an important part of kind of developing that service mentality, but also ensuring that we're linked into unions, that we are providing young people and citizens with the training that they need in these fields. I've also heard from, you know, witnesses at the Environment Committee, businesses, experts in the field of renewable energy, that we do not have the trained labor force to do the work that we need to do to reduce our emissions. If we are serious about a shift to a green economy, we need to make sure that we have skilled people coming into these fields. And right now that we don't have the numbers to do the work that we need to do.
And it could mean lots of different things, but for those listening, I mean, everything sounds good at a high level, but at a more granular level, what does this mean for a young person? Your best case scenario when someone says, what are you actually talking about? What's the example you offer?
Yeah, you know, I see a young person who wants to enroll in this program enrolling, and maybe they are interested in wetland restoration. So they get trained up in that area. They are provided with employment. They are in some ways kind of an apprentice during that time. And when they're done that service that they're doing and they're getting paid as they're doing it, they then are able to enter the workforce with job experience, with access to education, free education, so post-secondary or college training in the field that they're wanting to get into. Whether it is wetland restoration or maybe the person is interested in, grid interconnection or clean building, or, you know, we really see some tangible buckets that we could flush out when it comes to the job creation and the areas that we want youth to go into. And that is making our communities climate resilient, doing the work to ensure that we are adapting to climate change. And apologies, that is just my alarm.
The alarm saying your time is up. On the Canada Summer Job Site, just because you mentioned it, and yeah. I don't think it's the perfect vehicle as far as it goes, but let's say we don't see money, and I hope we do see money for this in the budget, but let's say we don't see money. I'm sure it was in your budget submission, it was in my budget submission, but let's say we don't see money. I do think that there's a way of taking the bones of Canada Summer Jobs and ensuring that green jobs, sustainable jobs, are a huge part of that. Instead of, for example, the many jobs that I think we aren't really creating, but we're subsidizing jobs that are going to be created anyway by the private sector. There are lots of nonprofit jobs that people should know that, you know, everyone gets $1 million+ in their writings from Canada Summer Jobs to distribute. And they're great in many ways, but there's still a lot of problematic allocations from Service Canada to at one year, the Tim Hortons on the boardwalk was going to get money. And I tried to stop that from happening. And so it's there is a way, I think, of reallocating some of those dollars to better ends.
And I think these are two things in my mind. One is Canada Summer Jobs, the reforms that needed, the investments needed. Similarly, in my writing, Dairy Queen was on the list of approved recipients where like, you know, transition houses who have been doing incredible work in my community were lower down. And, you know, you have to really fight for those organizations who are doing critical work to get that kind of support, and in a large part because of the flaws of the program, but also because the government has stopped investing at the level that is needed. You know, there was a bit more money during the pandemic, and then we saw a huge drop in funding. And it is a critical program, but it's not a youth climate corps.
And it's only an 8 to 16 week period of time, whereas what you're talking about is these longer term investments for young people to be properly trained in the areas of interest to make an impact in a sustainable way. Okay, I'm glad we're talking about the Youth Climate Corps. I mean, we could talk about areas we agree in many different ways. Here's an area where, I mean, we do, I want to get to an area where we maybe disagree a little bit more, but we do agree on phasing out fossil fuel subsidies. We've been on panels, you kindly included me, I think, in some kind of online pandemic rally, which was great. And it's important that we, I think, work across party lines to this end. There has been some movement, but you've still been critical. And so give us a snapshot of there's been progress, but the progress is insufficient in your view. And what more would you like to see on that front?
Yeah, so when we met in that town hall on eliminating fossil fuel subsidies, there was so much work to be done. And there still is a lot of work to be done. Since then, we have been able to negotiate and push your government to eliminate billions of dollars in international fossil fuel subsidies. And I think I'm really proud of the work that we did negotiating to get a strong framework. And unfortunately, the vast majority of our fossil fuel subsidies are domestic subsidies. And the framework that the government put forward, I have been extremely critical of, because it continues to have loopholes that allows the government to hand over billions of dollars of public tax money to profitable oil and gas companies. That is unacceptable in a climate crisis, especially at a time, just let me finish my thought,
especially at a time
when we're hearing from the government that they can't afford to fund a youth climate corps. This is just such a clear. And so the framework that was developed for public or domestic fossil fuel subsidies, there's a ton of loopholes in it, and it will screen out some, but is in no way close to the strength that we see on the international side when it comes to screening out fossil fuel subsidies. And then there's the other question of public financing more generally, and that's Export Development Canada. That work is still, like, we're in negotiations with your government. It is something that's clearly outlined in our agreement that this is something the Liberals have committed to doing and have yet so far failed to do. I'm going to keep pushing them on it. And it's so frustrating to know that there is a clear path to eliminate this money going into the pockets of rich CEOs and big oil and gas companies, but that for some reason, the Liberals continue to fail to do that. And I struggle with it, to be honest.
Can I ask on this? Because I think there will be no daylight in our advocacy around the, you mentioned EDC, and EDC is the problem, I would say, when you look at the public financing side of things. And specifically, we could spend a lot of time just dunking on the now, I think, $35 billion sinkhole that is Trans Mountain, and to say, imagine we spent $35 billion in a different way, whether it was to fight climate change or not, it would be a much more productive use of public capital. Having said that, when you say there are subsidies that flow into CEO pockets in big oil, sounds like something I would want to vote against. But what, like, let's be a bit more specific. Like, what is the loophole or what is the subsidy that you want to see close there?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number, but I would say the one where we might disagree, if we want to get to that, would be around carbon capture and storage. You know, this is something that big oil and gas companies have lobbied for. The, you know, experts, the, you know, top global experts have said carbon capture and storage is a very expensive, unproven technology, and that, in my personal opinion, if the oil and gas industry is so certain that this is a really good climate solution, in opposition to the top global scientists who have said money will be better spent on renewable energy, on other types of climate solutions, then let the oil and gas companies who are making record profits pay for this themselves. And they are developing this technology. You know, I'm glad the government isn't funding directly the enhanced oil recovery, but the part of the reason that oil and gas companies are so excited about this technology is because the vast majority of carbon capture and storage is used around the world for enhanced oil recovery, which means producing more oil. And, you know,
but they can't get the subsidy for that.
They can't get the subsidy for that, but they can develop the technology and then use it for that.
Okay, but it's not like we aren't directly subsidizing that problematic activity. I think the complaint there, I mean, I would share a complaint in a way, but it would be, I think, differently directed. The complaint I would have in that regard is more around opportunity cost, that would a public dollar be better spent elsewhere, as the experts you're referencing are articulating. I don't think it's as well cast as a subsidy for fossil fuels directly. Now, if it was for enhanced oil recovery, you would argue the case. But if it's not, then it would be more a wasted dollar in comparison to something we could do in a more impactful way. But it's not necessarily lining the – I don't see how it's lining the pockets of big oil in quite the same way.
Well, think about it this way, is that, you know, there is a framework that took away some millions of dollars away from fossil fuel companies. So stop giving them that money. But at the same time, the government said, here is $2.6 billion for you to access to do this other thing, which you should be doing anyway, that the government should be regulating them to do regardless. And so their books are, you know, they're actually ahead of the game. They, you know, got this, a few million dollars were stopped flowing into their pockets, but they got access to billions of dollars to do this thing that we should be expecting them to do anyway.
Yeah, and if they were going to do it anyway, then the point is well taken on a subsidy.
But a government can force them to do it, can regulate them to do it.
And there,
and this
I
is
think,
a difference between carrots and sticks.
Yeah. And there, I think, so in my budget submission, which, you know, we all come at this from different angles. I know Mike Morris, I just seconded his motion. He was calling for an excess profits tax on oil and gas. I proposed something similar, but what I proposed was sort of getting at the problem that you're articulating. It was, why don't we mandate an excess profits tax, but say the dollars can stay in your companies if you use it on certain things that you should be spending on anyway, but you aren't. And I mean, you know, then we could argue whether carbon capture and storage should be part of that picture. But I take your point. Like, they should be funding. They have the dollars and cents to fund it. They should be funding something rather than the overall taxpayer.
Absolutely. And you know, I wish that I had hope that, you know, the majority of Canadians support an excess profit tax on oil and gas companies. It's something other countries have done. You know, we actually, through our negotiations, pushed your government to do an excess profit tax on big banks. It's not a wild idea.
That was in our platform, though. That was in our platform.
Eliminating fossil fuels is also in your platform, but for some reason, it hasn't gotten done.
Yeah, fair. Now, the UK, you mentioned other countries. People should know. Conservative parties have done this. The UK Conservative Party has put an excess profits tax in place on oil and gas. So this isn't some radical, you know,
far left,
upset capitalism kind of idea. That, you know, there are many countries that have engaged in this, including conservative governments. I was going to get to carbon capture and storage. I'm glad you led there, because I do think I generally agree, you know, opportunity costs, as I say. I have been given pause, though, when I read the IPCC reports, and they do say there is likely to be a role for carbon capture and storage technologies, as undeveloped as they are, especially in sectors that are hard to decarbonize, and we're likely to need this technology.
If your government had said, let's invest in carbon capture and storage in the cement industry, let's invest in these companies up in, the Sunshine Coast that are doing kind of direct air capture, or the folks at UVic who are investing in carbon capture and storage in the seabed, the rock. These are, small startups, or, the cement industry, steel. Let's exclude big oil and gas, who are making record profits and can do this on their own. And let's instead regulate that industry to clean up their own pollution, to, clean up their own mess. Don't rely on the taxpayer to do it for them. I would have been in support of that. I'm not saying let's throw carbon capture and storage as a idea in full, but let's not hand out billions of dollars to big oil and gas companies who should be doing this work on their own.
It's sort of akin to, I think, a good comparison to highlight your point in a way is when you look at orphan oil wells and you say, shouldn't we mandate companies? And, some companies go bankrupt, it's one thing, but other companies are subs and they go bankrupt, but the parent company is not held liable. I mean, you do want a situation where as much as possible, you're mandating that the companies that are profiting from this overall activity are putting back into the system dollars to restore and to make sure that we are addressing orphan oil wells. You would take the same argument, I think, carbon capture and storage, and say, why is this on my tax bill when this should be on their tax bill?
Yeah, and it's the polluters pay principle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But at a time when those companies are making excess profits, when they are raking in, when they're giving their CEOs millions of dollars in bonuses, it feels obscene. It feels, Canadians are struggling right now, and we could better spend that money in so many ways, whether it is on climate action or supporting folks with affordability and the cost of living, or the combination of those things, which there's tons of amazing climate solutions that do both of those things together. It's deeply, deeply unfortunate.
How do you find, so I'm in a different position than you are. I mean, you're I assume running again. I'm not. So I'm in this position where I can be, not that I've shied away from saying what I want to say in the past, but I don't know. There's a certain freedom to it, I suppose. But it is a weird time where the Liberal Party is obviously struggling in the polls. And unfortunately for your party, it's not, you're not necessarily benefiting at our expense in the same way as the Poilievre Conservatives are. And so there's this weird time in the next year where I've been critical of my government, but your job is to be critical of the government and to hold the government to account and as best you can. At the same time, there are shared priorities. Climate's one. So you want to, on the one hand, say, Liberal government, you're not doing enough. You're terrible on this. You're terrible on this. You're terrible on this. But on the other hand, climate communications are a disaster at the moment. And you've got Poilievre holding Axe the Tax rallies with thousands of people showing up. And it's mind-blowing that we are just the dumbing down of our discourse to diminish smart policy is maddening. Do you think through this challenge in any way? I mean, I think through it because I'm a liberal, but maybe you don't bear the same responsibility. You should attack us. I don't know. But do you worry about this challenge?
I mean, I am worried about how the government is, this current liberal government is failing to communicate climate properly, but also how they are in a large part responsible for people's cynicism. You brought up Trans Mountain. When you declare a climate emergency one day and the very next day you purchase a pipeline.
Not great. Not great.
It makes people cynical. And when you make promises and then break them again and again and again, it does. Like, people came into, I think, the 2015 election with a lot of hope. I knew people who had voted Liberal for the first time because they promised, electoral reform. And the kind of cynicism...
You're just wanting to hurt my feelings at this point. Make every vote count. Yeah.
Yes.
I remember that.
People... It's like, and I don't mean it as a jab towards you, because I know that you care deeply about this, but I do think there is a real impact on people and people's ability to feel hope around the political process, their ability to engage meaningfully and to get excited about the potential that we could have if we had a government that cared deeply about tackling the climate crisis, that cared deeply about supporting Canadians. And we know that is not a Pierre Poilievre government. We, like, you and I have seen him over the years. You know, Canadians, I don't think, have gotten a chance to get to know him. They're just seeing the videos that he's putting out that are very polished, that present him in a very specific way, which is not who he is.
Except for the Touching Wood one. The Touching Wood one was very strange. But the but the other ones generally are pretty good,
I think he's doing a really good job at communicating a message and presenting an image of who he is, a person who cares about supporting people, which is not who he is. You know,
and he really likes rhyming. Really likes rhyming.
He really likes rhyming.
And good with a turn of phrase.
But I think the difficulty is that in a speech that was supposed to be about the climate crisis, on a topic about the climate crisis, he didn't mention the words climate once. He's not someone who is going to tackle this emergency with the with any kind of determination or with any desire to win. And he is also someone who has said incredibly problematic things when it comes to Indigenous people. He met with residential school deniers just this past, like, a year ago. And when the Harper government came out and finally apologized for residential schools, you know, Pierre Poilievre the same day said that these people don't, and this was his, don't need more money. They don't need compensation, is what he was saying. They need a better work ethic. You know, if we have any hope of having a Canada that is going to address reconciliation, that's going to address the climate crisis, but also address the affordability crisis and take care of people, make sure there is a social safety net and the support that people need when they need a hand up, you know, we need to fight tooth and nail to stop Pierre Poilievre from becoming prime minister. And unfortunately, I see the Liberal Party in a downward spiral, in a death spiral. So, you know.
Oh, death spiral. Okay, can I ask that so you laid out two cases for cynicism, okay?
Yeah.
Now I share cynicism on one front, because the Make Every Vote Count,
is it around,
I think,
electoral reform.
Yeah, so the Make Every Vote Count, I mean, we could go down a rabbit hole of, you know, the access to information laws and the, you know, I've adopted the free vote stance, but generally, like, the commitment to decentralized power, there are reasons to be cynical, I think, on the broad democratic reform agenda that was, I think, significant heading into 2015. Now, there have been changes at committee. I think committees operate much better today than they did in the Harper era. There have been changes where, you know, at least in our caucus, there is more freedom than there maybe has been in the past. And that's all good for democracy. So there have been wins. But on the Make Every Vote Count, on the electoral reform, obviously that was burned to the ground in an unceremonious way. I think, you know, they just killed M86 because they didn't want to talk about electoral reform, and there wasn't really a good rationale beyond that. So, like, I will say, put one in the Laurel column, you win that one, right? Now on climate, though, so this is, you bought a pipeline is a great line at the doorstep, and I cringe inside when I hear it. It hurts me. But I look at, we were elected in 2015, and feel free to, you'll get to completely tear this apart if you feel like it. But so we get elected in 2015, and projected 2030 emissions, the business as usual case, is 815 megatons. So if we do nothing at that point in time, and we just, like, you know, status quo, we just do exactly what Harper was planning to do, 815 megatons. But we don't do that because Jonathan Wilkinson's great, Catherine McKenna's great, the Prime Minister, I think, you know, despite buying a pipeline, there is a commitment to this issue in the same way there's a commitment to reconciliation, as imperfect as progress can be. And I wake up today and I could check the emissions progress report and look at where projected 2030 emissions are today with all policies that have been put in place, so long as they hold and they don't hold in a quality of government. But we're at 467 megatons, and that is a 43% reduction as against business as usual. Now, it's not enough. It's not enough in keeping with the sort of half by 2030 that the IPCC would say the world has to roughly get to. It's not in keeping even with the 40%, you know, we kind of cheat 40 to 45% target, but it's not in keeping with the 40% target. We're at 36%. We're, you know, and there's still a number of years of policymaking between now and 2030 to close that 4% gap. And I would say, hopefully, ratchet up our target even more by 2025 in keeping with the climate accountability law, and then more policymaking. And we should have much more stringent action between now and 2030 to drop that even further. But I don't think, and this is where I would end, I don't think that there's the same reason for cynicism insofar as you could say it's imperfect and you could complain for sure about Trans Mountain or about EDC and carbon capture and storage. You've got your list for sure, and I would have mine. But it's not in the same category as electoral reform, which was burned to the ground and never revived. Climate action is on the agenda, and Stephen Gilbo, Jonathan Wilkinson, they're really great people around the table, and 43% is major reduction from business as usual. Like, I think that's massive progress, not insufficient as it may be, but it's massive progress. And I'm not cynical on that one.
Okay, so I want to address two things off the bat. One is, you know, we definitely haven't met our, kind of, you said 36%. The projections are still not meeting the government's
There's a 4%, 40% delta. Yeah.
Absolutely. But that is projected. That's not where we're at right now. That's looking to the future. But that said, I'm holding two pieces because one, we ended our conversation and I wanted to kind of wrap up a thought, which I'm going to come back to. And I will start.
Well, I'm going to give you time. You can kill everything I said if you like. Do whatever you like.
I'm going to start with the fact that you have you know, an emissions reduction plan. The reason you have that is because of the Climate Accountability Act, which the government presented as an empty bill. It was so problematic, in fact, that the Conservatives supported it at first reading.
Agreed.
They said, well, this is empty, and so it's not going to do anything, so we don't mind supporting this. And I had to negotiate and fight tooth and nail to get any kind of accountability into that act. It was such a frustrating process working and trying to drag along your government into basic climate accountability. And similarly with the domestic fossil fuel framework, and I am sad, you know, I feel like we had a big success with the Climate Accountability Act, but when it comes to fossil fuel subsidies, we had big successes internationally, and then I am just so disappointed with how it ended up domestically. And why is it on the climate that every time we have to force your government into taking the smallest steps, the steps that then, you know, you can tout and say, oh, look at what we're doing. It's not enough, but it's still, we're making some progress. We forced you to make that progress and it isn't enough. And, you know, climate delay, yes, it's not climate denial. Yeah, you are not as bad as the Conservatives when it comes to climate change, but why should Canadians have to choose between bad and worse? You know, why do we have to choose between delay and denial? Why do we need to choose a government who refuses to actually look and face the fact that we need to listen to the IPCC report, that we actually need to have policies in alignment with that? And why are we still handing out billions of dollars to big oil and gas companies and saying we can't afford to invest in tangible climate solutions like a youth climate corps? I think Canadians are disappointed with this government when it comes to the climate crisis, and it's because they see that. They see that half measures are not enough. When we are facing a climate emergency, we need a response, a government response that treats it like an emergency, and that's not what we've seen. We've seen small steps. We've seen inadequate targets. We've seen, some movement and some movement that we have dragged out of this government, but we're not seeing an emergency response. And, you know, I think young people, but I think Canadians in general feel the fact that the climate crisis is here and we do not have a government that understands the gravity or is taking the action that matches the scale and urgency of the crisis that we face.
That's pretty good. I like that. I just want to quickly go back
before we go on to another topic. And, you know, you had asked about that, you know, that choice between the Liberals and the Conservatives, which I think, especially in Ontario, I'm out in BC, it's not as prevalent here, but that kind of strategic voting, Pierre Poilievre's so scary, we have to vote for the Liberals. I do think we're in a moment of time where that is no longer the case. I think I said death spiral, I apologize, but
but no, I laughed at death spiral because if the Liberals are in a death spiral, but they're still ahead of the NDP, where is the NDP?
Well, this is the thing. We are actually going up slightly. You know, it's for the first time in a very long time that we're statistically tied with the Liberals in a number of polls. We are going up and the Liberals are going down. If we get up just, you know, 2, 3, 4 points above the Liberals, all of a sudden, all of those people who would love to vote NDP, but feel like they have to vote for a worse party because of the electoral system that we're in, first past the post, forces them to strategically vote and, you know, vote for something that they don't like but don't hate as much in order to stop a party that they really don't like, that strategic voting piece will flip. And those folks will flow to the NDP. And we could see
there's an anyone but conservative voter, for sure. Yeah, there's an anyone but conservative swing that happens in elections. We see it in Ontario. It's happened where the anyone but conservatives have swung to the NDP. Anyone but conservatives have swung to the Liberals. And that unquestionably does happen. It will have a regional flavor to it, as it always does, in terms of where, the national numbers matter, but then, who's competitive in which ridings, who's competitive in different regions. But I thankfully am not following these numbers as maybe as closely as you are, because I'm not running again. But
Nate,
but you
aren't running again. So maybe this is an opportunity to ask you a question. You seem like, when I look at the stances you take, the values you hold, and the way that you vote, you seem like you might be a new Democrat. <at heart. laughs>
So it's interesting, but on some issues, certainly not, right? So I think on how did I put it in the last election? Because I run against the NDP, runs against me. I run against the NDP, and there are shared values, like on the opioid crisis, on homelessness and housing, on climate change, certainly. Like you and I would probably share most priorities when it comes to climate and when it fossil fuel subsidies and when it comes to the Youth Climate Corps. There are many things that we won't want to see that we haven't necessarily seen in quite the same way. And I am probably a bit more careful in my criticism, but we would share criticisms at different times. I do think, though, I'm drawn to the pragmatism of getting things done. I'm not above getting on a pedestal and yelling at the government as far as it goes. But I do think there's and I've seen this of certain New Democrat governments, for example, like in BC, for example. I think that New Democrat government, because they're in government, there is a pragmatism to them. And I joke with my friend Tim, who is a constituent of yours, I think, how does it feel to work for a Liberal government?
A good friend.
Yeah, it's like, how does it feel to work for a Liberal government? Because I think the Horgan government was pretty liberal, actually. Like, if you were to compare the Wynne government in Ontario versus the Horgan government in BC, I don't know that you draw a major distinction. And similarly, like, if Murray Rankin or you were living in Toronto, you may well be a Liberal as far as it goes, representing these communities. Because it depends, well, maybe Murray more than you, I don't know. But I generally am drawn also to make the math work, and how are you going to get the thing done in a serious way? And I guess there, and this isn't true of everyone. Like Murray Rankin, I thought, was one of the smartest people in the house. And you're great, and Nathan
my predecessor,
was great,
and
Taylor is great as succeeding Nathan. So there are great people in the NDP. But Matthew Green and I are very different in our politics. I don't want to promise anything and all of the above and suggest that there was here's a good example. There was a motion to impose a wealth tax or something along those lines, which I certainly support. But then it was like, and to do all these things. It wasn't a wealth tax. It was to claw back something. I forget what it was. But Daniel Blake, who I respect a great deal, but it was like, we're going to do this one measure on this one side, and then we're going to pay for all these different things. It was like, but it just doesn't work. And so how are you going to be effective in I would like to see a wealth tax. I'm not going to say it's going to pay for a basic income, though, because it can't, because we aren't going to raise enough revenue through a wealth tax to pay for a basic income. And so I think there's just a certain pragmatism. And I would say I want things to be sustainably financed so that they are sustainably there for people in need, as opposed to, you know, overspending and then cutting and overspending and cutting. And look, there are times I've disagreed with the Liberal government because they haven't spent enough. The other times because I think they're spending the wrong way. But I grew up in an NDP household, so I definitely lean a more, you know, more left and more progressive liberal. But it would be those. There's a certain pragmatism, and I want to be effective. And there's a certain, I would say, fiscal sustainability focus where I don't always see the NDP promises adding up in quite the same way.
Interesting, because the NDP's platform does actually balance in a more sustainable way, at least in the last election and in a number of them, because we're proposing wealth taxes, because we're proposing closing loopholes in offshore tax havens, because we're proposing really to make the biggest corporations, the people at the very, very top, pay their fair share and therefore can fund social programs.
But I agree. But like, that's the thing. I agree. So on the wealth tax side, I completely agree we should have a wealth tax. I think if the Liberal Party doesn't propose a wealth tax in the next election, they're making a horrible mistake. Yeah. Having said that, it's not going to pay for everything. And so the idea that you can do, and I think interestingly, you guys are running into this in the course of these negotiations with the Liberal Party and the Liberal government, because I think there is a certain pragmatism that seeps into your negotiations, because you can't do, PharmaCare is a very good example of this. PharmaCare is not going to be real in the same way childcare is real. We did childcare. Christia did childcare because she wanted to do childcare. And that wasn't like a, we're bent over a barrel decision. Whereas PharmaCare was more forced
onto the
agenda.
Although we have been pushing for childcare for decades. And finally, there's been a government who wanted to do it.
completely agree. But it's not the same as like you guys are at the table, you've got certain leverage and you say PharmaCare or else. And I don't think the Liberal government was going to pursue PharmaCare but for that negotiation. But but you guys have been pragmatic and said, well, we're going to be able to do these two things at the beginning. And that's a consequence of, you know, you didn't cause an election over it. You didn't jump up and down and say like that more or nothing else, because I think there's a recognition there's not this bottomless money pit that you can do everything all at once. There is a bit of pragmatism that seeps in. And so I think the closer you are to government, I think Tommy Douglas was pragmatic, Horgan pragmatic. I think the closer you are to government, that pragmatism generally seeps in, versus sort of like, you know,
so
shouting
really,
into the wind or shouting on TikTok.
You didn't
like,
want to be
know.
In opposition, is this?
No, it's not just that. It's there's a certain just seriousness to the plan that when I see the governments or the leaders in history, there's just a certain seriousness I've seen. Like I was a New Democrat when I was an undergrad, I was like, I left the party because it just wasn't. It just wasn't serious enough for me.
Jack Layton times.
I would have been an undergrad, so Andrew Horvath and Jack Layton.
Provincially. Okay, yeah.
And Jack's great, but it wasn't. It
Jack
was still.
Jack and Jugmeet do have that pragmatism. They have been able to really present tangible policies that are backed up, that have a pathway for fiscal responsibility, but also are looking out for Canadians' best interests. And they, you know, I love that we're talking about Jack just because he had such an incredible climate focus and was, you know, one of the first, I think, political leaders, Canadian leaders of a political party that really took this on in a meaningful way and made tangible impacts on the Canadian landscape because of it. You know, the Green Municipal Fund is only there because of Jack's advocacy.
When you say Jugmeet is the same, so take M86 as an example, and I think that if I were the leader of the NDP and I recognized that in the last 20 elections, the NDP has only outperformed its popular vote with seats in the House once out of 20 elections, electoral reform is like this existential issue for the NDP. If we don't see electoral reform, you are mostly going to be punished at the polls. And if I'm Jugmeet, and I know a citizens assembly is not going to change everything overnight, he could have got it. If he were more forceful, if he were at the negotiating table saying, this is a line we're going to draw in the sand, there's no way that the Liberal government's going to cause an election over a citizens' assembly on electoral reform. I know it's not always possible to go back to the table and renegotiate, but do you think he's effective enough? Like, I just don't see I just don't see enough effectiveness.
So, I mean, first of all, electoral reform, your government is absolutely not willing to touch with a 10-foot pole, and it is totally something that we first in our first things in our negotiations.
Yeah, oh yeah, in the negotiations,
and
yeah.
You folks were like, absolutely not.
Yeah, of course. Like that, of course.
Yeah. And so electoral reform, do we want to try and force an election around electoral reform? I don't think Canadians would support that. I don't think they're saying, let us change our electoral system and go to the polls about that.
In a game of electoral chicken, I think you guys win it, is all I'm saying. I just don't think there's like the shrewdness to it. I'm not a huge fan of like the TikTok versus the shrewdness, you know?
This is someone who got pharmacare, who got diabetes medication covered, contraception covered, you know, who got dental care. These are tangible pieces that make a difference in Canadians' lives as they are struggling with the cost of living. Like, we are seeing people go to food banks at record numbers. You know, have a leader in Jagmeet who understands that, who understands what people are going through, and uses his power in a minority government to change the material conditions of people, who like sees what they're going through and makes a difference for them. Like, that's the kind of leader
I
want to see.
Pharmacare is a bit of a kick down the road as far as it goes, but I do take the point of dental care.
When it comes to diabetes medication, like, I have spoken to people who cannot afford the devices,
it's a very important insulin thing.
They need.
Yeah, yeah, same. And it's a very important thing, but it's not like a dental care is being rolled out. Pharmacare is not like we're a ways away
in
from
the legislative process.
Yeah, yeah, we're a ways away from the families you're talking about getting help. But
we have secured the agreement, and it is going through the House.
But maybe I'm more NDP. But you know what? I don't know. Maybe I'm more NDP than Jagmeet Singh, because you know, if I were sitting at that table, I would be saying, dental care is a priority for me for sure, but it's not even close to the priority that Canada Disability Benefit is. And if I was at the negotiating table, I would have bent the government over backwards to say, you're doing CDB first, and that's the thing you're going to do, because that's going to lift people with disabilities out of poverty. Whereas, you know what the dental care benefit is going to do? It's going to help seniors who are already, in many cases, owning their homes and have a bunch of equity, and now they're going to get free dental care. And you're not going to help the 30-year-old disabled person with the benefit that they sorely deserve. And so, like, I probably would be
so
maybe
just to
more,
be clear, the
am I
dental
more
care
left
does,
than Jagmeet Singh?
The dental care does include people with disabilities. The dental
yes, I know, like, I know.
But that said, I do think the disability benefit is critically important. And it's interesting. I do contest with the way that you're using New Democrat, which is as if we're like, it's something unrealistic. And I think that comes from kind of an Ontario perspective on New Democrats as an opposition party alone. Whereas here in BC, we've had many New Democrat governments.
Yeah, yeah.
We know that New Democrats get stuff done for people. We are looking out for people's everyday
interests.
That's
why I said you'd be a Liberal Ontario. Maybe I'd be a New Democrat in BC. And, you know, I'll tell you a funny thing. This was after 2019, but it was in around that time. I'd been in Parliament for like 4 years. And Kevin Lamoureux, he comes up to me. He's like, oh, you should join this meeting of BC MPs. And I was like, Kevin, you know, I'm not a BC MP. And his mind exploded. And he was like, but, and I've been in caucus with this guy for years, and I thought, oh, opioid crisis, climate action, animal welfare, he thinks I'm from BC. And I was like, no, Kevin, Beaches East York is just a small slice of BC in Toronto.
I love that. Also, Kevin Lamoureux, sorry, have you watched The Princess Bride?
Yes, yeah, of course, yeah.
Okay, do you know the character who kidnaps the princess?
Yes, and yeah.
Okay, is that not Kevin? Like, don't you want to sit across in a game of wits with Kevin Lamoureux and like make him drink the poison? Every time he gets up, it's all I can think of.
That's really, really
at
funny.
One point we were in a debate about tailings ponds, and oh my goodness, Kevin Lamoureux, you know, the curl toxic tailings ponds leak is also a stain on Canada. The fact that we let Imperial Oil and other companies leak pollution into water and poison the drinking water for Indigenous communities is awful. We were in a debate. Kevin Lamoureux was saying some pretty atrocious things, I'm going to be honest, when it comes to your government's response to this, and that, you know, they would take tailings ponds as a reference out of the Canadian Environmental Protection Act. But he kept on saying tail ponds. And I think he just maybe isn't familiar with the term. He kept talking about tailpawns and tailpawns this, tailpawns that. And I wanted to get up and, you know, quote the Princess Bride and be like, that word that you keep saying, I do not think it means what you think it means. It's like my dream. At some point, political career, that is what I want to do.
Yeah, you should. Well, Kevin's at the place where he's like, you know, he's done this for so long. It took me a while, I will say. When I first was getting up, I was like, I had to have my speech written, and I would write it myself, and I, you know, did the thing because I was so, you know, this is for Hansard, and it's forever. And now there's a certain, I'm not going to read someone else's words, but I'm not as insistent upon having something written in advance. So you will get more comfortable to the place where you're like, you don't care what's in Hansard, you're just going to do the Princess Bride to Kevin Lamoureux. You know, maybe you're already at that place.
I'm not at that point. My hope is I get there someday.
Okay, so but we've talked a lot about climate, and I liked your question back to me. It's good. I wanted to finish off. You've got a private member's bill on course of control. What should people know about course of control?
Yeah. Well, course of control, it is an insidious form of domestic violence. And sometimes it includes physical violence, but oftentimes it doesn't. Oftentimes it's a precursor to physical violence. It's the way in which an intimate partner really controls the other person, and it could be cutting them off from their social support network, their family and their friends. It could be setting up cameras to monitor them or tracking them online. It could be controlling what they eat or what they wear. It is a pattern of behavior. And for me, I first witnessed this because my sister years ago showed up at my door in tears, and her partner had taken her bank card, had taken her keys, had taken her cell phone. Luckily, she had another set of keys and was able to get to my house. But, you know, she stayed with this person for a number of years, and, over the course it escalated. It eventually there was physical violence involved, and I'm so grateful she's now free from that relationship, doing great, and has given me permission to share her story. But this is a story that is all too common, and we need to do more to support survivors of intimate partner violence, victims of intimate partner violence. And so in the UK, in Scotland, and other jurisdictions, there are laws that protect people from coercive control. And we do not have such a law here in Canada. And so my private member's bill would be creating that. And it's going through the House of Commons right now. It has gotten all party support. At second reading, it's in committee, amendments are being made. I'm hopeful that it will still have all party support at third reading. And if folks are interested in this bill and want to support it, the next step is really writing to senators and asking them to make sure this bill passes. We're in a minority parliament. It needs to pass before an election is had. And so asking senators to quickly review the bill and get it passed. You know, it's one of these topics. I think everyone knows someone who has experienced this kind of abuse. And it is also the kind of abuse that is 95% of violent situations have elements of course of control. It is also the most common precursor before femicide, even in situations where there's been no violence in the lead up. And so this is a way to intervene before violence happens, before femicide happens. A woman is killed every 6 days in Canada from intimate partner violence. That is horrific. And we need to take action. This is a small piece and a small step forward.
I like that I may get all of this wrong, but before Parliament, you worked with Divest Victoria, and you were vocal on environmental issues. Here you are in Parliament, and you're the NDP environment critic, and you're living this and breathing this. And then you worked with Victoria Women in Need, and you were focused on, you know, in a personal, I don't know if it was paid or volunteer capacity, but you were focused on serving victims of domestic violence. And here you are in Parliament, and you're advancing the cause in a substantive way. And I quite like you haven't been in Parliament so very long. I think we're the same age, 39, soon to be 40. And yet you've been able to translate advocacy that you truly cared about as a citizen and as an advocate into substantive parliamentary work and making a difference.
I mean, this is honestly why I became a member of parliament. It's, you know, I spent a lot of time and I worked for Victoria Women Need as their program coordinator. And I have worked on environmental campaigns, protecting watersheds, you know, pushing for bold climate action. And pushing from the outside, we need those people. We need activists and advocates who are pushing the government from the outside. None of this would have happened without the survivors, without the frontline organizations who support survivors of intimate partner violence. You know, none of our climate work would happen if it weren't for folks pushing governments to take bold action. And we need people on the inside who actually understand the issues, who understand the scale of the crises that we face, and who are willing to do the work to get it done. And so, you know, being able to come in and actually, you know, I've been lucky. Both of the parliaments I've been part of have been minority governments, and I've been able to work across party lines in order to really push for the changes that I want to see. You know, back to our electoral reform conversation, I wish that we were in a system that didn't produce so many majority governments, because I'm not sure what it'll look like. We're doing this job in a majority setting if I were in opposition, because you don't have as many opportunities to really push forward policies and have the tangible impacts. This private members bill has cross-party, all-party support, which is rare for a private members bill. It's exciting to see people put aside their partisan differences and just say that this issue matters. It needs to be tackled.
Its timing is the only question. So, because the Senate can slow things down. They can sometimes do things quite quickly, but when do you expect it to clear the House?
So it's in committee right now. I'm hopeful that this week, cross my fingers, that it will leave committee. And so probably coming back for third reading in May and June.
We should be able to pass that then.
Crossing all my fingers.
Yeah, I think that's whereas my bill, which is a bit more contentious because the conservatives don't believe in preventing and preparing for the next pandemic, that bill is going to come up for probably a vote at third reading around the same time. I think we'll get it through the House before June, but I have every expectation that conservative senators will slow that in its tracks when it comes to the Senate. So it's such as life in Parliament.
Yeah, I just have to say, you know, I appreciate seeing you drawing the links between pandemic preparedness, but also climate action and environmental protection, animal rights. These are interconnected. And it's great to see those connections being made.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Well, we share a great deal in common, I think, overall. And I think if we're running down our list of advocacy, there's probably lots of different ways to work together. So as you think of the next thing that you're working on, I mean, do reach out. And if there are ways to work together over the next year, I'd be happy to work together. And then close, I think, because I think this is important for people to know about you, but just in general, you had a kid while, you know, as a parliamentarian, and it was a weird time because it was the pandemic, but a better time for parents in parliament. It was this weird, you know, among just a horrifying time, it was this bizarre silver lining that you got to spend more time at home in a way that you don't normally get to spend time. We do have virtual parliament still. I don't know. That's probably going to be canceled in a conservative government as well. I'm not running again in part because I've got a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, and my wife's doing her PhD and working, and she's busier than I am more than half the time. And I've done a longer stint. Do you see this something you're just, you know, you're committed to for a long period of time, and you're going to manage the family dynamics? How do you figure this all plays out as a young parent?
Yeah, so I have had 2 kids during my
holy
time
2 kids.
I have a 3-year-old and a 9-month-old.
Oh, congratulations! I did not know about the 9-month-old.
Yeah, and I'm lucky that I have a partner who's taken extended parental leave each time, and so the whole family comes out to Ottawa with me. The 4 of us will be flying out together on Sunday, and you know, it definitely is a juggling act, as I think many parents know. You know, having busy jobs and a busy parenting life, especially in the early years with kids, it is a lot. You don't get a lot of sleep. And I am really grateful that there's some flexibility with virtual parliament. It means that, you know, there was a week last month that I did completely virtual, which was wonderful to be able to have one more week in the constituency, not have to fly everyone out for that week.
most weeks I am in Ottawa, and so going back and forth, and it takes a toll. Absolutely. I love the job. I love the job. I hate the travel.
Yeah,
BC MPs have a very different job than you folks in Ontario as well.
Yeah, it's bad for me. Yeah, it's bad for me. And I'm like, I'm only a two, like, I can do 2.5 hours round trip door to door if I really am irresponsible getting to the airport very late. And
it's you've got minimum 10 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
Door to door for us.
Yeah.
With flight delays, oftentimes more. And so, once my kids are heading off to school, and maybe can't come back and forth as much, I'll definitely have to reassess and see how this job is, how I'm able to serve my constituents and how I'm able to be a great mom to my kids.
That's
make
exactly
sure that
the
those two things are happening.
Exactly the right answer, I think. I think it's a gut check you do before every election. And it's this question of, there's a huge sacrifice on the personal side, and am I making enough of a difference on the positive side of the ledger in terms of policy and everything else.
And building a future that you want for them.
Exactly. And is it, balancing those two questions, is it worth it for another go? And for me, the answer was no this time around, but I would come back at some point if that
maybe as a new Democrat
changes. See, here's, what's an interesting thing? I do think, you've dunked on Trudeau a few different times. But I do think, so in the lead up to, it was 2013 that I was running a nomination, that commitment to doing things differently, and it's not been perfect, but you use the climate accountability law as an example. It felt like pulling teeth, I'm sure, at different times, but that didn't exist, right? Like that you take a Harper era approach, or even you go further back, and majority governments did what they wanted to do, and that was a minority setting, but even in minority settings, they were, Harper had a number of minorities, like it was not constructive, right? It was like, we're going to do this and push us to an election if you want, blink. And I do think that there has been more of a, like, I've been able to have the freedom to get up in caucus and to disagree. I've had the freedom to get out and in the media, and I'll support the NDP motion on Monday. I'm sure the government won't. I mean, maybe they will, but I'm pretty sure they won't. And so there is an opportunity to disagree. So I think there have been many good things. I do think everything is sort of, are you inspired by the leader? Because whether we like it or not, there is always going to be a centralization. People are voting for the leader in many cases, as much as they're not really voting for the leader. And I do think you've got to be inspired to, the sacrifice for it to be worth it. You've got to feel like you're at the table to make a difference enough. I'm not really at the main table, but you got to feel enough at a table to make a difference. And you've got to, and I can point to Canada Workers' Benefit and the climate accountability law on my side. And there are lots of different ways I feel like I've made a difference over the years. Animal welfare, run down the list. But you've got to also feel inspired enough by the direction and who's there and the overall. I mean, if that's not there, then what's it all for? And, I do think we overall just lack sort of a seriousness and I don't put this at Trudeau's feet. Poilievre's the worst. I'm not that inspired. Jagmeet, I wouldn't come back for Jagmeet. I don't think he's inspiring either. So I don't know. I don't know. There are many good people. You're great. Other people are great, but I don't know.
Wholeheartedly disagree. Yeah.
You have to. Of course.
But I've spent the last 4 years, on Jagmeet's team, and he is someone who is genuine. He's authentic. He cares. He leads with compassion. He, is who he says he is.
It doesn't come across if that is. I'm sure it is the case. It does not come across.
Maybe it doesn't come across in Parliament, but you look at there's been polling done on this, and the words that Canadians use to describe Trudeau and Pierre Poilievre, 9 out of 10 of them were negative words. Things like inauthentic, untrustworthy, etc. Those types of words. When they described Jagmeet, 9 out of 10 were positive words. I think his authenticity and his genuineness do come through. Unfortunately, it hasn't translated in the polls and kind of the numbers, but I think given a political opportunity like the one that we have in the upcoming election, if that shift happens where we get a little bit above, there's a big opportunity. But I do want to plug
before you do that, I do agree. Authenticity is one of the most important things. I think it's the most important thing in many ways in politics. It's interesting that 9 out of 10. I don't know what that is. Maybe it's worth me looking at. But I don't get that.
I'll send you it after this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get that. I mean, maybe it's because I watch him in Parliament. But there's it looks like a lot of reading, and it's not like a, I don't know. It doesn't feel like a. Whereas Sean Fraser or you or Nathan Cullen, like when Nathan Cullen was running for the leadership of the NDP, I was like, that guy's the best. Like that guy's great. There's just like a on their feet. They're just wicked smart and serious. I don't, and that's part of you know. So authenticity matters. I think the seriousness really matters to me too. Anyway, okay, Youth Climate Corps, run.
Okay, I totally want to respond to what you just said, but I will resist the temptation. Youth Climate Corps, we are having a town hall on Monday, March 18th. And so I want to invite your listeners to join us. There's going to be in-person watch parties all across Canada. If you Google it, the Climate Emergency Unit has a list of where you can go to an in-person watch party. And you can also just tune in if you want to watch it from home and engage. We're going to be talking through kind of these bold ideas. We've invited MPs from all parties. We're going to have the Parliamentary Secretary for Environment and Climate Change, Adam Van Coverden from the Liberals. I believe Christina Michaud, she is on our poster, but there may be a block replacement last minute, potentially. We're sorting that out today. Blake Desjarlais is going to be from the NDP team. Elizabeth May will be there from the Greens. Unfortunately, the Conservatives declined, but the Climate Emergency Unit and myself will be co-hosting this conversation, and it's going to be great. I hope folks will join us for it.
That's great. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for the advocacy. I'm very glad to hear you're hosting that rally and not a Spike the Hike rally, so keep up the good work, and I hope to see you in Parliament.
Thanks so much, Nate.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of Uncommons. I will say, the idea that it's liberal, Tory, same old story, which was kind of the flavor that Laurel was putting out there at times, if one party was going to reduce emissions by 0% by 2030, and another party is already on pace to reduce them by 43% as against business as usual, I wouldn't necessarily put them in the same category. But you judge, you know, I think we both scored points as far as it goes. She's quite good at scoring points, so you be the judge as far as all of that goes. On future episodes, we are going to hear from the Environment Minister. I might put some of those pointed questions to him and see how he responds. So Minister Guilbeault will be joining us. We had Wilkinson join us. We might be able to cobble something together. Zoom might be able to recover that episode. They might not be able to. Very frustrating. I'm sorry, Jonathan. And otherwise, we're looking to have someone from the Suzuki Foundation, hopefully David Suzuki, maybe his daughter Severn, the new executive director, join us. So we'll continue to be focused on climate and environmental issues. There are other issues we'll tackle as well, including the online harms bill and more. If there are particular issues you want us to address and get into the weeds on this podcast, let us know. info@beynate. You can always reach me on social @beynate as well. And otherwise, until next time.